Previously on Beta.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
And never let go of it in his mind all the time. He kept thinking, I'm gonna be king, I'm gonna be king, I'm gonna be king. But he was still a baby. Because really only babies want to be king.
Now, the making of a good compilation tape is a very subtle art, many do's and don'ts. First of all, you're using someone else's poetry to express how you feel. This is a delicate thing.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Have you heard of the avant-garde band The Residents? Those guys in tuxedos with the giant eyeball heads?
I believe we show in the film a Ralph Waldo Emerson drawing and quote from way back that has a giant eyeball with a small top hat on it. So I think that really was their inspiration.
Don Hardy joins us to talk about his documentary, Theory of Obscurity, a film about The Residents. Also, remember draining batteries, flipping cassettes, and clunky headphones?
They compared it to cinema, to the experience of either watching a movie or being in one or both. They compared it to drugs. A lot of people talked about how intoxicating it was. It was a big sensation.
Rebecca Tuhus DeBrow takes us back to a time when the Walkman ruled the world. Gary Steingart never has to worry about writer's block. He has content coming out of his pores. That's what he told one interviewer, and we believe him. He's written several novels and a memoir. His latest novel is called Lake Success. It's about a narcissistic, self-deluded hedge fund manager named Barry Cohen, who re-examines his life with a cross-country bus trip. Gary often makes very funny trailers for his books, and for the Lake Success trailer, he teamed up with Ben Stiller.
Hey, are you white?
Are you a male?
Did you play lacrosse at one of these 14 schools?
Then the exciting world of hedge funds might be right for you.
Hi, I'm Ben Stiller.
And I'm Gary Steingart. And together we're
Lake Success Capital!
Woo!
Yeah, that was...
It's great.
Thank you. That was one of the most fun to make. The idea that I had was, you know, in 2 minutes, can I sort of distill the essence of Lake Success, or at least the hedge fund part of it? And so the idea is, and you can see this online, of course, is that basically we're saying that if you're white and you're male and you played lacrosse at one of 14 colleges, you can get a spot in a hedge fund, even if you keep losing money. And then one of the characters loses $500 million on llama futures, but that's not a problem for us because he's still a white male.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very funny and very well done. So what inspired you to write your new novel, Lake Success?
I think it was basically this feeling that, you know, I am kind of a chronicler of Manhattan, where I've lived for most of my life, and I realized all my friends were gone. Nobody could afford it anymore, so they're all in, places like Chicago or Berlin or L.A. or the Mid-Hudson Valley, where I spent half the year as well. And the only people left were people who worked in banks or the people who loved them, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that was the, I thought, well, I got to write about what's in front of me, and what was in front of me were hedge fund managers and, you know, lowly investment bankers, but mostly hedge fund managers and private equity people. And so I decided to write about that since they were the only people left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Can you give us, now would be a good time for you to give us kind of a Cliff's Notes summary of Lake Success without, of course, revealing any spoilers, if that's possible.
Well, the Cliff Notes version is sort of a man who has all the money he could ever need, has a kind of nervous breakdown for several reasons. One, of course, is that his hedge fund is being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and is also failing in many ways. But the major reason is that he realizes his wife doesn't love him, and his idea of a perfect life that he wanted to lead with his family is disrupted when his first child is on the autistic spectrum and nonverbal. So he decides that in order to elude the SEC and also to get away from this failed marriage and family, in his view, he decides to run away on a Greyhound bus in search of his long-lost college girlfriend who now finds herself in El Paso, Texas. So it's a kind of, I think at one point the book describes it as a middle-aged version of On the Road.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of accurate. Yeah. All the dreams and excitement have been replaced with a feeling of, oh my God, I really screwed up.
Yeah, a lot of regret. Yeah, looking back rather than looking ahead. Well, one of the themes you explore in the book is neurodiversity. As you mentioned, Barry's 3-year-old son, Shiva, has been diagnosed as autistic, and it's possible that Barry might be on the spectrum too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you want to explore this theme?
So many people I know have kids who are on the spectrum, and when I look back at the children that were my friends when I came to America and couldn't speak the language, I was, you know, kind of, nobody wanted to play with me. I wore this giant coat made out of Soviet gerbil or whatnot, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
but the friends that I did have, when I look back at the way many of them behaved, I mean, there's, once you learn a lot about the spectrum, I realized that, you know, without being able to diagnose them, of course, but many of them had some of the sort of stereotype movements and way of talking and interacting that possibly were on the spectrum. So I've always had a great appreciation for people like that. And also, you know, I've been meeting Temple Grandin in the last 2 years was one of the great highlights of
my life. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she's hilarious too, which is goes against what people think of autistic people as being, you know, unable to express certain emotions. Everything is there. It's a communication disorder. And Temple communicates in her own way, but she's, you know, smarter and more intellectual than most of the people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this stuff kind of combined to create for me a portrait of a character, a book that would sort of have neurodiversity in it. Now, also, many of the hedge fund guys I would meet would talk about their fellow competitors and say, well, Jim is on the spectrum or Bob is on the spectrum, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm unable to, you know, diagnose anyone, obviously, but it was almost like one of the main things they wanted to say about each other was that they had better social skills than someone else, although in general, there were some very poor social skills on display. The other thing they would say about each other is, you know, oh, Biff's mom never loved them. You know, they diagnose bad behavior through using either the spectrum or a lack of love. And those two things, the spectrum and a lack of love, are possible ideas for how Barry got to be where he is.
Yeah, yeah.
Emotionally and otherwise.
Yeah. I'm still not sure I understand exactly what a hedge fund is, and I've tried to look it up online. Like, you did a good job of explaining it, but I'm wondering, can you give me kind of a brief, witty, suitably Steingartian definition of what a hedge fund is?
Sure. A hedge fund is a way to make a couple of people very wealthy. And those couple of people usually aren't investors. Sometimes they are, but usually the people that are really made wealthy through hedge funds are people who actually run them. The hedge fund uses a 2-in-20 model. So what that means is, if you give me $100 million, I get to keep 2% of that, or $2 million, no matter how well or how poorly my hedge fund performs every year. And I also get to make 20% of the profits that are on top of that. But theoretically, I can keep losing money year after year. And if you give me $100 million, I will take $2 million of that every year, or whatever 2% of the remaining amount is.
Wow.
So the main part, and hedge funds invest in everything. So in that funny video I made with Ben Stiller, the trailer for the book, one of our workers loses $500 million on llama futures. What are llama futures? I don't know. We made them up. But almost anything can be traded,
mm-hmm.
including, of course, the derivatives that sent the economy crashing in 2008. So essentially, I see hedge funds as a way to transfer money. And remember also that, you know, capital gains, all these other taxes, they're offshore. There's ways to not pay taxes on this income.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Essentially, all this is a giant scheme to transfer money from poor people, from the middle class, into the pockets of a tiny 0.01% of the population. And, of course, the last couple of years have only enabled that to happen all the more.
Thank you. That really helps. That helps me understand it. Man, I should get into the hedge fund business.
I know. What are we doing?
What are we doing?
You know, yeah. Writing books and doing radio.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, but, well, no, writing books, you're doing well for yourself. I think so. You said in an interview that Lake Success is basically journalism masquerading as fiction most of the time, and it struck me that, in a sense, it's almost been an immersion journalism project for you, because mm-hmm. in addition to talking to all the hedge fund managers, you also took the very same cross country bus trip that Barry does. So did you do a lot more research for this book than you did for your three previous novels?
I think the only book where I did in perhaps an equal amount of journalistic type of work for a novel was Absurdistan, where I actually hung out in all of those post-Soviet republics which comprise Absurdistan. But yeah, this was, I haven't done this much research in a very long time. And yeah, taking the hound, as we call it, or
yes,
the dog across the country in the span of 4 months was exhausting. It was one of those sort of something you do on a dare. A lot of passengers did go huge distances, 20-hour trips, 24-hour trips. But this was a trip that took place, so I did the same thing as Barry. I would get off the hound and spend time in the very cities in which Barry spends time, which is Baltimore, Richmond, Virginia, Atlanta, Jackson, Miss, El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez across the border in Mexico, and then Phoenix and San Diego.
The Greyhound bus trip storyline really resonated with me because it brought back memories of this Greyhound bus trip I took with my dad many years ago, but our bus trip wasn't nearly as exciting as Barry's. Instead of the one-eyed Mexican guy falling asleep on my father's shoulder, it was me falling asleep on his shoulder and saying, get off my shoulder. I'm trying to sleep and stuff. So how? Yeah, you mentioned where you went, the route or route, I could say. How did you decide which places to go? Why did you choose those particular cities?
I thought of places that were interesting, and all these cities have interesting histories. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted to take a route through the South.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, you know, when you look at the way our country works, the South has an outsized influence, I think. It's almost like the Confederate War never, the Civil War never ended. It's almost like the Confederacy is ascendant in many ways, or at least in the ways that it gets to set the dialogue for this country. There was an incident on the Greyhound bus that was very interesting that is described in the book, but that also happened to me. And that was in, let's call the state Louisiana, you know. And I was on the bus, and all of a sudden there was a gaggle of white supremacists showed up on a bus that was mostly people of color and started talking very loudly about crucifying Muslims and Jews to start with. And I belonged to one of those groups. Barry gets off the bus and buys a New Testament coloring book in Shreveport, Louisiana to hold up as proof of his Christianity. And I saw the same thing and thought of doing the same. And at one point we passed Grambling State University, a traditionally African-American college. And one of these white supremacists, while quoting Breitbart and other sources, said, they have their colleges, meaning African Americans, and one day we'll have ours. What part of Dartmouth don't you understand?
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But the shock of that was that, I mean, of course people have always thought these horrible things. But in the first summer of Trump in 2016, people could get up on a bus that was mostly people of color and proclaim these things. And what we did was we looked away. We pretended we were asleep. We didn't challenge them even though we were in the majority. Mm-hmm. And I think this book is partly about that. It's partly about the ascendancy of this kind of new America. An America we can possibly roll back, but an America I think we're presently living in right now.
That's right, yeah. You yourself are an immigrant, so I'm curious if taking the cross-country bus trip and writing Lake Success has changed the way that you view the idea of the American dream?
Yeah. You know what was weird is, I mean, you know, I mentioned those white supremacists on the bus.
Yeah.
You could tell that they were in some measure on the way down. And that a lot of the other people on the bus were, in some ways, on the way up. They were trying to, you know, they were working hard. They were they saw an opportunity that was offered them to advance in life. And many of the people were self-billing themselves as part of this forgotten America, right? Mm. Of course, all of this had a hugely racist undertone.
Yeah.
But the country itself is beautiful, you know, and this is what you miss when you are sequestered in any kind of bubble in any place in the world. And I think New York and London form some of the biggest bubbles ever known since the time of Rome, the Roman Empire, when Rome was its own sort of planet. But the beauty of the country, from the foothills to the mesas, is so striking. And as seen through a Greyhound window, which is a pretty big window if you find the right place to sit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like the country becomes its own show. You know, the country just wants to flaunt itself to you and show off, and it's gorgeous. And you know, the difficulty of that journey was that it was a very ugly summer, which gave way to a very ugly fall and winter and several years of it. But the ugliness of what was happening around me and sometimes inside the bus contrasted so wildly with the beauty of our country.
Yeah. Has writing Lake Success helped you to come to some sort of an insight into what's going on here in the United States at this moment?
We've created, somehow magically created, a society that by 2018 does not work.
Yeah.
It's a money transfer society with money flowing upwards. Once the money leaves the pockets of the people, of course their lives are harder. Of course they struggle more. But the people who are the beneficiaries of that money, the people who get the capital gains, tax breaks, and all the other things, they're not happy either.
Yeah.
It's almost a feudal society, you know, with nobody really happy about it, because America used, the idea of America, of course it didn't work for all people, but the idea of America is that we were all part of a community. There were differences in income, but, you know, a person who ran a company didn't make 8 million times more than the lowest worker in the company. All this stuff is new, and finance has exacerbated it, and tech has exacerbated it, to the point where nobody feels like there is an America that is something greater than the sum of just a couple of, you know, a couple of areas, a couple of geographical areas, or the social class you belong to. And that is a disaster, and that is why I think outside powers, well, one power in particular, are so able to exploit us.
Yeah, yeah, very well said. Final question, Gary. What do you want people to take away from reading Lake Success?
I have to say, I don't usually do this sort of didactic thing where I'm like, the reader must Y, and Z.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in the end, it's a portrait of a family in crisis, a family falling apart, maybe trying to come back together. In the end, it's how we live. For me, what's interesting in fiction is the personal is set against the background of the social.
Yeah.
And so that's the greater society and the smaller characters. I mean, War and Peace, of course, is the best example of that, right? It's set during major historic, cataclysmic historic events. But you only get to know those events through the eyes and ears and of the characters that you love, of lovers and families, and that's what I wanted Lake Success to be. Not War and Peace, of course, but a portrait of a slice of American history as seen through the eyes of one family.
Gary Steingart is the author of the novel Lake Success. You can find out more about Gary at wpr.org/beta.
The best compliment I received since the film has been out is from a 12-year-old girl that got dragged to see it by her father. She came up to me after the screening and said, I thought that the residents were just some dumb thing my dad was into, but now after watching this, it makes me want to go out and make art.
Don Hardy joins us to talk about his documentary, Theory of Obscurity, a film about the residents. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. The Residents are a renegade sound and video collective that's been making their own rules for 50 years. They always perform in disguise, and no one knows who they are. If anyone should know the true identities of the band, it's Don Hardy. He's the director of Theory of Obscurity, a film about the Residents. So I asked Don this very question. Who are the Residents?
I'll never tell.
Give us a hint. Can you give us a few hints?
Well, the Residents are a music and art collective started in San Francisco back in the early 70s, and they've remained anonymous all these years, so I can't divulge it right now.
Okay, so why did you want to make a documentary about the Residents?
Well, I've lived in the Bay Area for a number of years now, and it's really become home to me. And one of the things I like so much about being out here is there's a lot of mysteries. And one night over drinks with a couple of friends, we started talking about the Residents. And honestly, it was a band I didn't know much about. But hearing my friends Josh Keppel and Bart Bischoff talk about them, and Josh had known them a little bit. He helped shoot a concert DVD for them. And Bart had been a lifelong fan, and just hearing how they talked about the band, it just seemed very interesting and very much about the Bay Area as a whole, especially the art scene back in that early 70s time period. So it just seemed like a very interesting subject to try to tackle, to try to tell a story about a band where you can't interview the band.
And you, as you mentioned, you weren't really a fan of the band before you started making the film. Did you become one as you were making the film?
Yeah, absolutely. There's some albums I like more than others, but I really appreciate what the Residents stand for, which is this idea of creating art without celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that's
yeah.
so rare in our world today. And it's something that is a core belief that they have, is that the work should stand for itself.
Mm-hmm.
And you should do what you really want to do, what drives you, and not necessarily what the fans want.
This is a band that has managed to remain anonymous since they started in 1974. So I'm guessing that one of the biggest challenges you faced in making your film was, how do you make an authoritative documentary about this group? Was that something you thought a lot about before filming?
Probably I didn't think about it enough, or I wouldn't have gone down that road.
Yeah.
But it had to do with their 40th anniversary. That really drove the idea for making the film, that, hey, they're going out to do this 40th anniversary tour, and it's the first time in their long history that they've really been in a reflective place where they're talking about all of the different ups and downs of their career. So it was a perfect time to try to document them.
Mm-hmm.
So we jumped in just shooting the shows, and we went all over the country, including through Milwaukee with them, shot at the very cool Turner Hall. That was an experience. That was our way in. So we got to know the people that surround the band at that point, and then started figuring out how we were going to construct the storyline.
Mm.
What interviews we needed to get that with different people that could illuminate certain periods of the Residents' history. You know, people that had collaborated with them or artists that they had influenced. And that shaped the film.
One thing I wanted to run by you, I recently read Ian Shirley's book about the Residents that came out a few years ago, and I really enjoyed it, but I have to confess that I haven't enjoyed listening to the Residents' music nearly as much as I've enjoyed reading about the music and the band. I wish I liked the music more, and maybe I just haven't listened to it enough. You have that great clip from Les Claypool of the band Primus.
It's like a fungus. It just kind of takes over, and then you kind of get used to the fungus, and then you learn to appreciate the fungus. So the Residents was a big part of my musical fungus.
Is that kind of how it worked for you? Was there sort of a fungal quality about getting into their music?
Yeah, it's very fungal. That's a good way to put it. But I think to look at the Residents as a whole, it isn't just about the music. It's about the art that goes along with it. And you don't have to like it all. In fact, I don't think anybody could sit here and say, well, maybe there's a couple of super fans. They would say they love everything they've ever done. But it is very varied.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
there's
yeah.
some earlier albums, like I would say Fingerprints and Duckstab, and you know, maybe those are two of the more accessible ones. And then there's an album like Eskimo that's very tough.
So when you were putting this film together, were you thinking about trying to find the most accessible samples of their music to put into the film? Was that something that you thought about a lot?
No, I can't say I really thought about that. But what drove me was to try to not just tell the rock documentary. I find music docs as a whole to be very boring. What interested me the most about the Residents is that they just played by their own rules. And you could go anywhere with it. The best compliment I received since the film has been out is from a 12-year-old girl that got dragged to see it from by her father, who had like collaborated on an art project with the Residents 20 years ago. And she came up to me after the screening and said, I thought that the Residents were just some dumb thing my dad was into, but now after watching this, it makes me want to go out and make art.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
And so if more people can take that away from it, that you don't have to necessarily like them,
mm-hmm.
but like what they stand for, and like that they didn't contemplate the what-ifs of could they be successful musicians. They just said, in fact, they didn't even know how to play their instruments.
Yeah.
But it made them create something else.
Yeah. There's that great quote from Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller, who actually worked with the Residents early on, but he has that great quote just along what you were saying about,
no matter what you think of the first record, they finished it. No matter what you think of the second record, they finished it. No matter what you think of the Mole Show tour, they did it. No matter what you think of Violinist Fats, okay, they didn't finish that. But you know, the idea is they learned to run the video equipment. That's a lesson in life. That's a lesson for not how you're the greatest avant-garde band of all time, but it's also how you start a dry cleaning business. It's also how you do road repair. If you wait until you understand enough to do something, you're never going to get it done.
Yeah, so they are very inspiring in that way, yeah. The title of your film is Theory of Obscurity, and this is a real theory that exists in the history of the residents. Can you tell me about this theory?
Yeah, it was an idea that came up from this possibly real character named Ensenada.
He's the one that, as I understand it, is credited with the theory of obscurity. And the theory of obscurity is that artists do their best work in obscurity, and they do their best work when they're free from the scrutiny of fans, press, criticism. If they're obscure, they're free to do whatever purely comes out of them.
It's just like you can do whatever you want when you're free of that. So if you're living in obscurity, then you can do whatever you want to do.
The residents, of course, as you mentioned earlier, they're famous for their eyeball heads and top hats. How did they come up with this visual trademark?
It came about when they were putting together the key art for their album Eskimo that I believe came out in 81, 82. And they were looking for an image and this idea of some kind of orb that would go over their heads. And initially, it was going to be a mirror. And at some point, they realized that that wouldn't really work. So the mirror changed into, like, a mirror pointed out at the audience, which is a pretty neat idea.
Oh, yeah.
But then it morphed into an eyeball. And there's a lot of stuff, I believe we show in the film, a Ralph Waldo Emerson drawing and quote from way back that has a giant eyeball with a small top hat on it. So
yeah.
I think that really was their inspiration.
Yeah.
But it's one of those stories that's kind of up for debate. With the residents, the truth is lost somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And even when you talk with the different members of the Cryptic Corporation, their management company, you get a different story.
Yeah, tell them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just trying to make the best out of where it really came from. But somewhere in there went from a mirror to an eyeball to the back image, the back album image for Eskimo, to realizing, wow, this is a very strong image. We might as well put it on the front of the album.
Yeah, and someone, really, as someone says in your documentary, I think it's a member, someone from the Cryptic Corporation says,
if you look back at the summation of their career, what's their biggest hit? It's a t-shirt. They have a hit t-shirt. But, I mean, you know, there's something that's real pop culture about them.
And because they're anonymous, there have been all kinds of rumors about who the residents really are, right? Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, that was something we really wanted to play with early on, is this idea that anybody could be a resident. And so there's talk that the Beatles were actually residents in disguise.
Yeah, yeah.
David Byrne has long been suspected to be a resident.
Yeah, Bob Seger, too, hasn't he?
Sure,
been?
Bob Seger, absolutely. Yeah. Barbara Streisand.
Yeah. Barbara Streisand, yeah, yeah. So the residence management team is called the Cryptic Corporation. Can you tell me about them? Because it's a very interesting arrangement, the way they have them, and it's part of the whole thing of them being this more of an art music collective rather than a band.
Yeah, well, these same guys that moved out from Louisiana formed this corporation basically to manage the residents. The residents are free to just go out and make whatever art they want to make and record, and they needed somebody to handle all of their business affairs. That became the Cryptic Corporation. And so they've managed them, and only them, for almost 50 years now.
Wow.
And along the way, they formed their own record label, Ralph Records, and distributed other artists' work, but their primary artist has always been the residents. Mm.
Back when MTV first hit the airwaves in the, when was that, mid-80s, 86, whenever, they actually played music videos, viewers could often see music videos by the residents on MTV.
Yeah.
And one of them was for a song called Hello Skinny. Can you tell me a bit about this music video?
Yeah, when MTV first started, they had very little content to actually put on there, so the residents became one of the bands in high rotation, which is so bizarre knowing how MTV changed over the decades.
Yeah.
So they had this clip laying around for a video for a song called Hello Skinny that is very strange. It's a clip directed by Graham Whiffler, who is an early collaborator with The Residents.
I'd never seen a music video, but it kind of made sense. Well, we'll do a short film to just a song.
Skinner was born in a bathtub and grew so incredibly thin that even the end of an eyedropper sucked him in.
Did some other videos for folks like Snakefinger and Ronaldo in the Loaf was another one that he went on to direct some movies and TV. But Graham did this clip for Hello Skinny, and it stars just one strange figure and follows his travels through a night in, I guess, San Francisco. And ultimately, they use a lot of still photos in there and do some movement on the still photos. But it's a very creepy clip. And while we were digging through all of the archives to make the film, we unearthed all this footage that was like outtakes from Hello Skinny, and have used those to, we kind of did new masters of all of those old videos was one of the things we did while making the movie.
The Residents have always been early adopters of technology. They've made laser discs, CD-ROMs, and they even did this podcast experiment a few years ago. How important do you think the band's embrace of technology has been to their longevity and the fact that they're still going?
Well, I think it's huge because they have really jumped onto new technology, and it just shows where their interest really lies. And if they could have played their instruments better, they wouldn't have experimented so much. But yeah. They wanted to be able to take things and loop them and sample them and move them around and play with them by duplicating them and smashing it all together. That was always an interest for them. That really put them ahead of the curve, and I think they still are doing that healthy, that curiosity with technology. But it also has been to their detriment in a way that a lot of this technology doesn't last. Mm. So you mentioned like Laserdisc. Okay, yeah. Well, good luck with that, or CD-ROMs.
Yeah, yeah. Their fans include Matt Groening, who of course is the creator of The Simpsons, and Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller, and Penn actually worked with The Residents. What did those guys tell you about why they love The Residents?
It's that freedom that we've talked about a bit. You know, and so for Matt, it was something that in his early years, when he was first in L.A., he just found The Residents and knew it was something different. And it did inspire him in a lot of ways to just start creating.
So who are the Residents fans? Is there a typical Residents fan?
We kind of laugh and joke that it's, you know, when the Residents go on tour, it's the first chance a lot of people get to come out of their parents' basement. But it's not that. It's really not the case. Like, there are a lot of guys that, you know, definitely the comic book crowd is certainly part of it. But what we've been seeing lately is that a lot of people are bringing their kids. It's a multi-generational thing now for Residents fans. And you see a lot of people, you know, I think because the film has been out there a bit, I think it has attracted new viewers to the Residents as well.
So near the end of your film, we see the Residents' entire archive be installed and displayed, put on permanent exhibition, right, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City?
Yeah, it's part of the permanent collection. It isn't always on exhibition,
yeah.
But they're waiting for the next, you know, maybe they'll create a show about, like, post-punk. That seems to be where the Residents get placed a lot, is like the post-punk no wave kind of area. So the next time that will be there, their archive will be on display. And, you know, because the Residents never do anything the easy way, what we delivered to the MoMA that you can see in the film is one of their ultimate box sets, and it's every official recording they ever did along with one of the original eyeballs delivered in a refrigerator. That is the ultimate box.
Right, which is why then we see the entire archive is housed in a refrigerator at the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah.
What do you want people to take away from watching Theory of Obscurity, a film about the Residents?
Well, I guess the idea that you don't have to follow what everybody else is doing. Mm-hmm. If there's something that really motivates you, go do it. And I certainly find this in my film work. If I had ever known how hard it was going to be to not only make a film but then get it out into the world, I probably wouldn't have gone down this path. I would have stayed in my role as a journalist and collected my paycheck every couple of weeks, and that would have been a simpler route. But I took the journey, and you know, I'm happy to say that it's worked out so far. I think that would be my biggest takeaway from it for other people is if there's something that drives you, just do it.
Don Hardy is the director of Theory of Obscurity, a film about the residents. You can find out more about Don and the residents' story at wpr.org/beta.
In order to make it small enough to be the kind of portable device that they wanted it to be, they had to remove the recording function. So that just seemed preposterous to them at the time.
We rewind to a time before iPods. Rebecca Tuhus DeBrow joins us to talk about the history of the Walkman. That's next. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya is making a name for himself with his debut short story collection, Friday Black. Adjei-Brenya uses mind-bending premises to explore racism and cultural unrest. He also takes on the horrors of consumerism with his title story, Friday Black. Here's Adjei-Brenya reading an excerpt.
Maybe 80 people rushed through the gate, clawing and stampeding, pushing racks and bodies aside. Have you ever seen people run from a fire or gunshots? It's like that, with less fear and more hunger. From my cabin, I see a child, a girl maybe 6 years old, disappear as the wave of consumer fervor swallows her up. She is sprawled face down with dirty shoe prints on her pink coat. Lance walks up to the small pink body. He's pulling a pallet jack and holding a huge push broom. He thrusts the broom head into her side and tries to sweep her onto the pallet jack so he can roll her to the section we've designated for bodies. As he touches her, a woman wearing a gray scarf pushes him away and yanks the girl to her feet. I imagine the mother explaining that her tiny daughter isn't dead yet. She pulls the little girl toward me. The girl limps and tries to keep up, and then I have to forget about them.
Blue Sun Sneak Puck.
A man with wild eyes and a bubble vest screams as he grabs my left ankle. White foam drips from his mouth. I use my right foot to stomp his hand and I feel his fingers crush beneath my boot. He howls,
Sneak Puck, son,
while licking his injured hand. I look him in the eyes. Deep red around the lids, redder at the corners. I understand him perfectly. What he's saying is this. My son loves me most on Christmas. I have him holidays, me and him. Wants the one thing, only thing. His mother won't. On me. Need to feel like father. Ever since the first time, since the bite, I can speak Black Friday. Or I can understand it at least. Not fluently, but well enough. I have some of them in me. I hear the people, the sizes, the model, the make, and the reason. Even if all they're doing is foaming at the mouth. I use my reach to pull a medium-sized blue sleek pack pole face from a face-out rack way up on the wall.
Thanks,
he growls when I throw the jacket in his face.
Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya is the author of the short story collection Friday Black.
Oh, remember the mixtape we made? It's like 25 of our favorite songs. Oh, okay. Listen, take the tape cassette out. Yeah, take it out. And snap it in two. All right. See how big that is now? That's what you'll listen to music on. It'll be that big. You'll listen to music on it digitally. Wow, how many songs does it hold? Every song you've ever heard or will ever hear or will ever be written, you can put on that thing.
If you're old enough, you remember that there was a time when we didn't walk around listening to music on our iPods. We listened to music on a device called the Walkman. And if you're too young to remember the Walkman, we thank you for helping us attract that coveted 18 to 34-year-old demographic. Please recommend Beta to all of your fellow 18 to 34-year-olds. Rebecca Tuhus de Brau was born in 1978, the year before the Walkman debuted. Even though she was just a toddler during the Walkman's early years, she's gone on to write a book called Personal Stereo. We're going to go old school analog with this one. This is Beta after all. I've got my Walkman here. Here we go. Get the cassette in there. Close the top. Press play. Here goes.
I had very fond memories of listening to a Walkman when I was a kid, a teenager. And that was really the main impetus when I found out about this series of which it is a part, the Object Lessons series. I just immediately thought Walkman. It just came to me. And then when I started to think about it more and research it more, I realized that it was an even richer subject than I had originally realized because, as I say in the book, the Walkman was arguably the first mass personal device. It was the first time people were carrying a device around with them in public that provided them with their own personal form of entertainment. You can argue there was the transistor radio, but this was more individualized and immersive. So I started to see it as the ancestor of our current personal devices and started to learn about the ways that it had influenced and changed public space at the time that it was introduced in the early 80s.
Sony introduces the only cassette player as small as a cassette case, the incredible sounding Super Walkman.
So that I found really fascinating because the ways that we use personal devices today, I think, is such a salient feature of public space and social life. I loved listening to it when I took walks. I used to ride a lot of buses, and I would just put on my headphones and kind of slip away and daydream. So I have memories of it being a really magical experience.
Of course, there was also, in addition to the magical transporting experience that you would have when listening to the Walkman, there are also the dreaded technical difficulties that were part of the Walkman listening experience. And you have a great paragraph early in the book about the technical glitches. Would you mind reading that for us?
Sure. So just for context, in the previous paragraph, I'm just kind of rhapsodizing about the 90s and my Walkman and my fond memories. So this paragraph starts, "Less fond, but still kind of endearing, are my memories of technological glitches. There was the dread that gripped me when the music started to slow, first almost imperceptibly, so I could cling to the hope that my fear was paranoia. But then the voices would stretch and deepen.
Madonna would become a baritone.
This meant my batteries were running out, and I would have to endure the rest of my journey without a soundtrack. When the ribbon got caught and mangled in the player, I had to try to extricate it, smooth it out, and stick my finger in one of the holes in the cassette to roll it back up.
So who invented the Walkman?
Sony came out with it in 1979. And there are a bunch of different stories about how they came up with the idea. But basically, they were the ones who brought it to the world.
Yeah, and it was two guys in particular, right? Akio Morita and Masaru Ibuka, is that right?
Yeah. They were the co-founders of Sony. Nobody at the company thought it was a good idea. They thought it would be a complete flop.
Why?
Because, first of all, it just wasn't done. People just didn't listen to headphones in public at the time. It just looked really weird. I guess they thought that
it was kind of antisocial to mm-hmm. go around listening to music that no one else could hear.
There was a concern that Sony employees doubted anyone would want a tape player that wasn't able to record. Wasn't that also a reason why there wasn't much enthusiasm?
Yeah, because at the time it was called a tape recorder, so that was a really integral part of its function. And in order to make it small enough to be the kind of portable device that they wanted it to be, they had to remove the recording function. So that just seemed preposterous to them at the time because they were tape recorder engineers. So they thought a tape recorder that doesn't record, that's a deficient product.
Yeah, because that's going against the way technological progress usually works, right?
Usually
right. a device will add functions
right.
rather than
take subtract.
One away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Walkman debuted in July of 1979. How was it received?
It was rapturous. People almost immediately, they just loved it for some of the reasons I've already mentioned, just this kind of unprecedented, intimate experience of listening to music right next to your ears and being able to move through a landscape, through a city at the same time. They compared it to cinema, to the experience of either watching a movie or being in one or both. They compared it to drugs. A lot of people talked about how intoxicating it was. It was a big sensation.
And one of the reasons you point out that people often compared it to cinema was that film was the first medium to introduce this idea of non-diegetic sound. Can you
right.
talk about what non-diegetic sound is and how that applies to using a Walkman?
Yeah, so in a movie, there's the sounds that correspond to what's actually happening on screen, like footsteps or speaking, or if the characters are actually listening to music, it could be music. But then there's the soundtrack, the music that the audience hears, but the characters are not supposed to hear. And that latter kind is called non-diegetic. So if you're walking down a city street and you alone are hearing music as you watch this scene unfold, that kind of replicates the experience of watching a movie.
As you point out, people couldn't talk about the Walkman without talking about its louder, larger predecessor, the boombox, which was also known as the boogie box or the ghetto blaster. How did the arrival of the Walkman change public conversation about the boombox?
Since the boombox had just fairly recently achieved some popularity and some people really loved it, it was kind of festive. One term that I came across was a sonic campfire.
Mm.
You know, someone would bring a boombox to the park and people would gather around and basically have a party. But of course, not everyone felt that way. And when people would blast their music on the subways, a lot of people found it pretty annoying. So the Walkman was frequently compared to the boombox and it was seen as more courteous because you weren't imposing your choice of music on everyone around you. But it was also the fact that when you listened to the Walkman, you were having this private experience in public space and you were kind of withdrawn into yourself. That was also unsettling to a lot of people.
And I think somebody in early news coverage, a man on the street that was quoted by a reporter, called the Walkman the thinking man's box. And you, as you mentioned there, there's this contrast emerging between the two approaches. You've got this more social and gregarious but also intrusive approach that the boombox represents, and then you've got this more polite, private approach, which people using a Walkman are, and also withdrawn, and so one's more confrontational and in some cases political, and the other is more inward-looking and kind of apolitical, so it creates a very different influence on public space and civic life.
Yeah.
The Walkman wasn't just a portable listening device that changed when and where we listened to music. You argue that it was a symbol of the 1980s. Can you explain that?
I found it fascinating that the Walkman could play these different roles. For teenagers, it was seen as just a way of being kind of lazy and self-indulgent. And for yuppies, it was seen as a way of being very energetic and goal-oriented and self-improving.
Rebecca Tuhus Dubrow is the author of Personal Stereo. Send us your favorite mixtape or playlist to beta@wpr.org.
She was a Walkman girl in a Walkman world. She had a private symphony inside of a cranial lung. And that gum she chewed fast to think she'd move. She had a pink on his brief. Mind of a wild geranium.
That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hit rewind on this episode or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight, I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I can't hate him. He is so transparent in his self-interest that I kind of respect him.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
First of all, great show today. You were terrific. Your big mouth was a revelation.